and welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up in Preston. And Nikki Radio in Hertfordshire and our listeners in Swindon. You can also access the show on radioforall.net. I'm Kirsty Paul.
And I'm Kay Sanganaffy. Coming up in the show.
Oh, it's always the variety and the different windows into people's lives you get, particularly when you're sort of doing little documentary pieces about community projects sometimes and whatever it is, yeah.
Andrew Brown, architect, throws a different light on what happened to the Twin Towers on 9/11.
Oh, it's always the variety and the different windows into people's lives you get, particularly when you're sort of doing little documentary pieces about community projects sometimes and whatever it is, yeah.
Fallout shelter at Peterborough in Cambridge.
Three High Court judges have cleared the way for coverage.
It was announced today that the replacement for the Atlantic conveyor, the container ship lost in the Falklands conflict, will be built in Japan. A spokesman for Q moving in, and they say the third world countries like Bolivia, which produce the drug, are suffering from rising violence, economic damage, and political instability.
Tell me true, tell me why was Jesus crucified? Was it for this that Daddy died? Was it you? Was it me? Did I watch too much TV? Is that a hint of accusation in your eyes? If it wasn't for the nips being so good at building ships, the yards would still be open on the Clyde. And it can't be much fun for them beneath the rising sun, with all their kids committing suicide. What have we done? Maggie, what have we done? What have we done to England?
Thank you.
That was Post-War Dream by Pink Floyd.
So here in the studio we have Jeremy Levitt to talk about guns.
Specifically the development of small arms in the modern British Army.
From what period?
1900s.
What developed from 1900s?
Weapons have changed a great deal in the last 100 years. Probably the most counterintuitive thing is that the rifle round that's fired by British soldiers today, and most soldiers in the world today, it's a standard NATO round, is actually considerably shorter ranged and less powerful than that was which was being fired 100 years ago. So soldiers in the First World War essentially carried a more powerful rifle than they do today. So Lee Enfield, which British soldiers would carry in the First World War, had an effective range of almost 800 metres. It was a very large, heavy rifle, powerful 303 cartridge.
So what has developed from the 1900s in guns?
Well, most interestingly, and I think counterintuitively, is that a British soldier of today is carrying a rifle which has substantially less range and power than that which was carried by Tommy of 100 years ago.
And why would they want a less powerful gun?
Combat rifles are now designed so that your individual soldier can carry a great deal of ammunition so that he is effective at fairly short ranges, up to about 400 metres, and capable of higher rates of fire in short-range encounters. And the infantryman of 100 years ago was trained and armed to be able to fight at about 800 metres. Rifles had that effective range, and troops drilled in volley fire so that they could effectively shoot at this very long range. During the first half of the 20th century, this was standard procedure in almost all armies. I mean, the British had our Lee Enfield and 303 cartridge. The Germans had their G98 and its 792mm Mauser cartridge. Americans had various forms of 30 caliber. And this was standard, this was accepted. It's partly because of how infantry fought, which was a throwback to the 19th century, where there were no tanks, there were no aircraft. There were essentially three main arms of the military: infantry, cavalry, and artillery. And the infantry all fought with the same weapon, they all fought at the same range. You had very large units of men who would all be trained to volley fire at someone from a set range.
So no real strategy, just fight.
A great deal of strategy, but not much diversity in weapons. Unlike today, where you can see that your standard infantry unit will have men with wide variety of rifles, machine guns, rocket launchers, and they might ride around in an armoured vehicle, which might be supported by aircraft, and you will see all this in the same battle at the same time. Whereas, for instance, at the Battle of the Somme, you would have largely a great deal of artillery behind the lines, a great deal of infantry out front.
And what are the main types of guns we have today?
Main types of guns we have today, the British Army has the L85, or SA-80, different names, same rifle, which is an assault rifle. It holds 30 rounds, it's effective out to about 400 metres. We also have several light machine guns, the FN Mini-Me and the FN Mag. Quite recently we've also had the sharpshooter rifle, which is used in Afghanistan quite a lot, which brings much more range. And interestingly, the sharpshooter rifle is a bit of a throwback to these old bolt-action rifles in that it has large, powerful cartridge which shoots out to a great long range. And these large, heavy bolt-action rifles, they were very effective for their time. But in the Second World War, two particular things happened. Firstly, machining and weapons design developed to the point that you could equip your infantrymen with a reliable semi-automatic or automatic firearm. So submachine guns, which are short-range, rapid-firing weapons, firing pistol rounds, became very widely used in the Second World War. After the Second World War, all sides analysed combat to try and improve their forces for the next war, and found that most infantry combat was actually taking place at ranges of about 400 metres or even less. And so the large, powerful, heavy battle rifles of the previous 50 years were actually more powerful than was necessary, and they were giving their soldiers this great big heavy rifle with these great big heavy cartridges to fire from it. The Soviet Union were the first to really understand this, and they developed a lighter intermediate cartridge, which is a smaller version of a standard rifle cartridge, which had less gunpowder in it, but the same size bullet. And they developed first the SKS and then the famous AK-47, which combined the ability to fire automatically, that is, rapidly, rather than having to be manually operated after each shot. The Kalashnikov was self-loading, like a machine gun, but small enough to be carried by a single man. And an intermediate cartridge, which was only effective out to around 400 metres, but it was smaller and it was lighter than the cartridges which had been carried beforehand, thus a soldier could carry more of them. And many other nations copied this sort of design afterwards, which led to British EM2 Janssen, which was developed and which was very advanced for its time but was never actually adopted, which was developed in the 1950s, and the American M16, which they first used in Vietnam and still use to this day.
Types of guns like the rifle, has the kind of general idea stayed the same or has the idea developed?
A cartridge is, it is now and it has been for more than 100 years. The current sort of brass cartridge as we use it was first really widely used in the 1880s. There's a bullet, which is the part which flies out and hits the other bloke. The brass case around it, usually brass, some used lacquered steel or whatever other material, which contains the gunpowder, has the bullet wedged into one end, and a primer at the bottom. And the cartridge is loaded into a gun by whatever mechanism, by whether it's self-loading or bolt action or whatever. The firing pin strikes the primer, which causes the powder inside to explode, which pushes the bullet down the barrel, being spun by the rifling grooves on the inside of the barrel, which stabilise it, after which the brass case, which is now empty, is ejected from the gun. There are three main types of cartridge in use today. These are very broad categories. So rifle cartridges, which generally speaking have a great deal of range and power. They can effectively kill a man from 800 metres, a kilometre, if you can hit him. Pistol cartridges, which are used in pistols and also submachine guns, which are much smaller, much lighter, much less powerful. They're likely to kill a man from, say, 50 metres away, but you'll want to use a lot more than one. And intermediate cartridges, which are this creation of the Second World War. The earliest ones were essentially just shorter rifle cartridges. They used the same bullet, but far less powder. And so they could have roughly equivalent killing power and effectiveness at mid-range without needing the added weight of long-range.
And is it cartridges that have changed more significantly, or the guns themselves?
It's both. In a well-designed weapon system is a combination of a cartridge and a rifle which are designed for one another, and a lot of the greatest flaws in weapons have come when someone tries to design a rifle for someone else's cartridge. You'd be shocked how similar a rifle cartridge today is to one that was used in the First World War. The Russians are still using the same cartridges they did 110 years ago. Both have changed, essentially. Cartridges most used use the same principles but are generally smaller, lighter. They are effective at shorter ranges, and rifles have been designed to be correspondingly smaller, lighter, able to fire more rapidly, but there are still niches for weapons of the old sort of range and power. After adopting the SA-80 in the 1980s, which was considered a very effective weapon for the types of fights which the British Army was likely to engage in, which was to say urban combat, some open field combat, against presumably the armies of the Soviet Union somewhere in Germany. We've found in Afghanistan, where engagement ranges are much longer because generally you'll be fighting over quite wide open areas, that our SA-80s don't actually have the effective range that's needed for this, hence the introduction of a sharpshooter rifle a few years ago, which is like a modern version of an old battle rifle. It combines the design features which have been developed in the last 50 years of a semi-automatic, quite light weapon, part of which is made of polymers, and it's modular, and you can add many accessories to it, with the same old principles of a large, powerful cartridge. Real combat as we see it in Afghanistan now, or in Iraq in the last few years, real combat where it takes place between groups of men with rifles generally involves both sides getting behind as much cover as they can and firing at one another until they can bring fellow units in to support by outmaneuvering or call in air support. Your average firefight in Afghanistan, I'm informed, mostly involves sitting tight, taking pot shots to attempt to pin the enemy down, and then calling in air support where you can.
What do you think is going to change in guns and warfare in the future?
Basic technology of infantry rifles hasn't changed in a very long time. There are two particular technologies which everyone has been discussing since the 1960s, which would be the next obvious step in small arms, which is caseless ammunition, which is to say that instead of a cartridge with a metal case, you just have a block of propellant with a bullet inside it, and you load that in and you fire it, and you don't need to eject the case, which would mean that your soldiers are carrying a lot less weight around. And guided rounds, which have their own subsystems on them, so that you can effectively guide them onto the target. And it's hard to say. The Germans, in fact, in the 80s, designed a weapon which did effectively use caseless rounds, but it was so complicated and so expensive that it wasn't really worth the effort of putting into production. And they're rather like fusion power in that everyone says they're 10 years in the future, and people have been saying that since the idea first came up. Ultimately, I'm not sure how much change we will see in the infantry rifle, because change, as it happens in the military, is very rarely just a matter of what is technically possible, but it's what is feasible, what is considered a good idea. For instance, if Britain wants to adopt a new cartridge in this Cold War, post-Cold War world, we're not just going it alone, we're not thinking, right, what one round is best for Britain. We are part of NATO, we have to use a standard NATO cartridge, and there's a great institutional inertia towards change, because if you're trying to adopt a new weapon, you have to buy tremendous quantities of this, you have to train all your soldiers in its use, you need to standardise ammo with your allies. And so far, there has been very little which is good enough of an improvement that it's worth all that hassle.
You also have to consider, how much of a role will infantry play in the future with drones and things coming into play?
People have been predicting the obsolescence of infantry since at least the invention of a tank, possibly the invention of the horse. I believe there will always be some role for an infantryman and his rifle in the wars of the future, because nothing else can actually hold anything. You can bomb a town flat, you can bomb a country flat without ever having to send in a man with his rifle, but if you want to do anything which isn't simply destroying it, if you want to protect, if you want to occupy, if you want to capture, if you just want to talk to someone, you will always need infantry. And while the role of infantry in directly attacking a position, as we would have in the First World War, is less significant these days, stand-up warfare between nations has not really happened very much in our lifetimes. If you look at our war in Afghanistan now, that is largely a war which is fought between small groups of men with rifles and supported with mortars and machine guns and so on. Or in Mali right now, the French are fighting with aircraft and with armoured cars, but also with infantry, with rifles. And infantry have an ability to hold terrain, and nothing can ever quite replace infantry in what they do. And as long as that remains true, there will always be a role for rifles.
Thank you very much. On the theme of war, we're going to hear a poem read by Malcolm Grieve.
Mass by Cesar Vallejo. At the end of the battle, the fighter lay dead. A man came to him and said, "Don't die. I love you too much." But the corpse, alas, went on dying. Two came to him and again said, "Don't leave us. Take heart. Come back to life." But the corpse, alas, went on dying. Then 20, 100, 1,000, 500,000 came, crying, "So much love, and yet so powerless against death." But the corpse, alas, went on dying. Millions surrounded him, pleading together, "Brother, don't leave us." But the corpse, alas, went on dying. Then all the men on earth stood round him. The corpse eyed them sadly, overwhelmed. He got up slowly, embraced the first man, started to walk.
No one has ever got to the bottom of what really happened on that fateful day. Andrew Brown, an architect, is with us in the studio to talk about the Twin Towers from a structural perspective.
The World Financial Center, we heard a big bang, and then we saw smoke coming out, and everybody started running out, and we saw the plane on the other side of the building, and there was smoke everywhere, and people are jumping out the windows. Over there, they're jumping out the windows, I guess because they're trying to save themselves, I don't know.
Are you crazy? dead.
Were there other people that were hurt, were lying?
There was a lot of people hurt. They were lying on the floors, coming down the stairs. A lot of people had asthma attacks while they were coming down. It was bad.
And what just happened now?
The building just came down. One of them. I don't know which one came down. I don't know if it was one or two.
So we have in the studio Andrew Brown with us. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, you're an architect and you're with us today to talk about 9/11.
That's right. Firstly, I was trained as an architect and I have worked in London briefly on high-rise buildings, not as the lead architect, but as a young assistant. Nowadays, I'm involved in research. I'm interested in historical research. A good friend of mine, Tom, last autumn, mentioned to me that there was some interesting video evidence on websites and knew my background in architecture and thought I might be interested. So I decided to just follow up one or two leads, switched on to a website which looked professionally produced and was amazed very quickly by what I saw. And it's changed my views about what went on the day because I'd never done any extensive research other than seeing a few newspaper pictures and a very brief TV footage. That was it. And it really surprised me what I learned on that afternoon.
So you went to a website, had a look at the actual footage, and this suggested something to you.
Well, yes, the websites are very well put together, and they're put together by a very professional group of people in America, American citizens. The leader of the movement of the website that I first accessed is an architect by training called Richard Gage. He works in San Francisco. He has his own architectural practice and he's an associate of the Institute of American Architects, so he's professionally recognised. For a number of years, he's worked on high-rise buildings and he knows basically how you design the structures of high-rise buildings so that they're strong, stable, safe. And he was actually alerted to problems with the official stories about 9/11 by a theologian, in fact, who was interested in government cover-ups. And as soon as Richard Gage started to look at the stories, as a professional architect with a lot of detailed knowledge of structures in 2006, he realised that the official stories just don't stack up. And he contacted his friends, structural engineers. Some of the structural engineers spoke to demolition experts and they all very quickly came to the view that all three of the huge modern steel frame skyscrapers that came down 9/11 in Manhattan were demolished by special high technology modern explosives by controlled demolition. The third tower that came down never had any collision with a jet and had only localized fires. That's what they call the smoking gun. They then looked at the way in which WT1 and WT2, the two great World Trade Center twin towers, symbol of the Manhattan skyline, came down, and they could not have fallen in the way that they did by the impact of the jets or by the quite localized fires caused by the fuel on board in the jets. And they moved on from there to contact as many experts around the world as they could, and they now have an organization called Architects and Engineers 9/11 for Truth, which has a large number of signatures of professional people. They've contacted scientists, and they have a movement which is slowly gaining ground, but still we don't seem to know about much about it in this country.
So that's very interesting. Has anyone from this organisation come and spoken in the UK?
Well, they have, and this is part of the story that's very interesting for us here in Bristol. Richard Gage has visited this country twice. He's spoken in London twice. I think he first came in 2008. He spoke in London and he was invited by the students to visit Cambridge University Department of Architecture, which is my old school. And he also visited Bristol. Bristol is the only other place that he's spoken in England that I know of. He came back in 2011, spoke at the RIBA, which is the Professional Institute of Architects in London. There's been very little reporting of those talks. I think some newspapers are scared of this, actually, because they got it so badly wrong in their reporting of the story originally. For instance, in 2011, when he spoke at the RIBA, it was reported in the Building Design, an architect's newspaper. I think it was reported in one or two other newspapers, possibly the Daily Telegraph, but the Times, for instance, was completely silent. So I think there is a conspiracy, and the conspiracy is a conspiracy of silence, not only in this country, of course, but also in America, that a large amount of compelling technical evidence has been released on video, in scientific reports, peer group reviewed reports, and the newspapers are afraid to touch it because they got the story wrong. And people like Murdoch don't like the story that's coming out anyway because it doesn't suit his purposes.
So for the man on the street, we believe that 9/11 were terrorists. Does this insinuate then that this?
Well, let me be clear. Richard Gage is an American architect. He works for big business in San Francisco. He has no anti-capitalist agenda. He's intelligent, well-spoken. He doesn't make traps for himself by saying unwise things in public meetings. His agenda is not to attack America or certain aspects of the way they do things in the world. It is to point out that the government misled the people. The man in the street, if you like, was the most misled. May I also make clear that he's well aware that the jets did crash into the towers and there was a terrorist element. The point that he and his engineering colleagues have been making is that the jets alone had nothing like the weight or the amount of fuel to cause anything more than local damage to those huge and very strong steel structures. And if you like, it's what some Americans have called a false flag event. In other words, what they're saying is that, yes, the terrorist thing was real, but it wasn't enough to cause that huge amount of damage. The huge amount of damage was caused by specially planted explosives, planted obviously in advance of the event, which suggests that somebody in the American secret government system, behind the people that we know about, knew about the terrorist plans. In fact, we know that anyway because the government had been warned, hacked in, if you like, to their plans, used them as a false front. And then in order to make a much greater impact on television screens around the world, they made sure that not just localized damage to the towers occurred, but that the whole tower would come down, making a massive impact on the world in general. And of course, thereby making it easier to put their plan of action to invade various countries around the world and to seize resources that they wish to have their hands on easier to achieve. But I must stress that Richard Gage is interested in the structure of the buildings, the cover-up on technical issues, the inadequacy of the official government reports. He doesn't want to go into the political agenda before establishing that the official story about the towers is a massive lie, and that a lot of technically qualified people know this and have known it from day one. The engineer who designed the towers in the 1960s knew that they were designed to withstand an airstrike from a Boeing 707, which was the jet widely used with four engines in the 1960s. The 767s that collided with the towers are slightly heavier, but not much heavier than a 707, and they didn't cause more than local damage. You may remember that WT1, the North Tower, which was the one first struck, didn't in fact fall until 1 hour 40 minutes later. The fires had largely burnt out by that stage. You could see that from the localised black smoke, and the towers beneath showed no great signs of buckling or undue strain. So something very strange was there right from the beginning. And, of course, engineers and demolition experts, fire prevention experts on the site already had their suspicions about something very strange happening. Even stranger, I come back to WT7, the third tower that fell, what Richard Gage has called the smoking gun, no collision with a plane. It said that some debris from the towers had hit WT7, which was more than 100 feet away from the biggest towers, and that had set off localised fires. But the localised fires were nothing like large enough to cause anything more than local damage to that tower, and yet at 5:20 in the afternoon, it fell. Extraordinary, inexplicable by normal principles of the way that large steel structures behave in fires.
How has evidence gathering for this gone ahead?
Well, that's very interesting. Right from the beginning, there were people on the site, like engineers, who were collecting samples, luckily for us, of the dust which was spread all over South Manhattan. Because you've got to remember that there were architects and engineers within, you know, fairly small radius of those towers when they came down who must have come out and been very surprised by what they saw. One of the engineers who designed the original towers was fairly early on looking at the site of the collapse. Now, one of the things that astonished him was that even 21 days after the collapse, he was looking at the area underneath the towers, the pile of broken concrete and a certain amount of steel at the base of the towers, and there was still molten steel, and there were still reactions going on in steel, which had to be because of something other than the kerosene, which would have burned only minutes after the initial impact. And steel doesn't melt in kerosene fires, which structural engineers will tell you. So there was something that didn't fit with the idea that the plane strikes alone had caused those huge structures to fall. And this was known early on. But the government commissioned an official body called NIST, which is, I think, the National Institute of science and technology to provide a report which would explain what had happened. The report is full of obvious gaps, and this has been remarked upon by many scientists and experts, including the great American scientist Lynn Margulis before she died in 2007. To give you an example about how strange the reports are, it is required by law in America for investigating bodies to examine the possibility that in the case of a catastrophic large building collapse, explosives were involved. In this case, they ruled out explosives from day one, and they never looked at the possibility that explosives might have been involved. They only looked at the idea that the fires caused by the jets caused the towers to fall. Well, that's a non-starter. It just doesn't make sense. Someone's trying to cover something up there. Well, I think, I've said what I think needs to be said. So I would recommend anyone who's interested to go to the websites, because they're very well put together. A&E, Architects and Engineers, 9/11 Truth. If you just type in A&E 9/11 Truth, you'll get something on a search engine straight away. Then ask, why is our hopeless media system not telling us about this? Because it's available. Any journalist worth his salt should know about this. Why has David Aronovich refused to take up the debate which he started with Richard Gage when Richard Gage was last in London? I think he's running squared. Why is the Times nothing to say about this, though it seems to me it's one of the most significant news stories in the world today? Why is none of Murdoch's empire telling us about this in simple terms? Because one or two other newspapers have mentioned it, and I think there have been a few television programmes in this country that just touch on the margins of it. But we need to know. I think we need to know. It's only fair for all those people who died on that date that justice should be pursued. It's not fair on the architects and engineers and the constructors who built those buildings for people to believe that they failed.
Andrew Brown, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time for the money slot, and this week we've got some useful information about mortgages from Phil Clark.
Phil is a mortgage advisor. Thanks very much for joining us, Phil.
Pleasure.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your company?
Yes, so Bristol Mortgage Online started about 3 years ago in that format, although I've been in the business for about 25 years. We're a whole-of-market mortgage brokerage, which basically means we can go to the whole market and research for mortgages.
So is that what we'd understand by somebody being quite independent then,
as a mortgage advisor? Yes, definitely. Normally you have two types of advisors, one that's normally tied to a bank or a building society, and someone like myself who can shop around to every single bank or business society. So we do all of the groundwork. A lot of these things these days are on software packages and sourcing systems, which are updated every single day. So we'll have one to rate at touch of a button, which we can find out in 2 or 3 seconds, really, depending on someone's criteria. So it saves all the phone calls, all the looking through the internet. It's just at a touch of a button.
I would come to you and say, this is a job I do, this is the money that I earn, and could you let me know how much I could get as a mortgage? Is that generally how people approach you?
Generally, yes. And these days, it's a lot more difficult to get a mortgage since 2008. And so every lender has different criteria. And it's just like putting a jigsaw really together and just finding all the different pieces. So we need to look at all the variable different factors, and lenders' criteria changes every month depending on what the criteria is for certain lending schemes. So it's just listening half the time. I think you're listening to what somebody wants. The most important thing is the facts and figures are very simple, very straightforward. The most important thing is the client, what the client wants to do now, but also in the future. So it's really, most of my job, I think, is basically listening.
And picking up the right information. So you refer to 2008, and that obviously refers to the subprime crash in America.
We first heard about it here through Northern Rock. But the whole world now is economically connected. I think what will happen in one country will happen, it will have a ripple effect throughout the whole of the world, really. So it's starting to ease a bit now. We see lenders come back in the market, starting to give mortgage arrangements, which they were doing pre-2008. But it's still a very difficult market now.
I think if you have your typical first-time buyer, obviously you've got a couple of generations of your family, and your granny will tell you there's no way you can get a 95% mortgage these days. Oh, you're definitely going to need 40% to get your mortgage. Is that correct?
Very good question. I mean, there are lots of ways of doing this, really. The only issue I would say is that when you're looking for a very high loan-to-value mortgage, 95, and there are some 100% mortgages there, normally the rate you're paying is a lot higher. But more importantly, the lending criteria is very, very strict. So there are some schemes out there which basically say they'll give you everything, technically, but you'll have to be the queen to get it.
So this is their form of insuring that people that can't afford that kind of scenario are not going to get into a mortgage for those circumstances. Because in the past, we have heard about a lot of people that have been able to get mortgages, and now it seems to be a lot more restricted.
Yes, indeed. And you'll find maybe, for example, someone looking for a 90% mortgage will have a set criteria from the lender, and someone looking for a 70% mortgage, they'll be a lot more flexible on a multiple of income for how much they can afford to borrow.
And the difference between a fixed or a variable mortgage?
Well, there are normally the main types of mortgage you can go for, as far as this is concerned, is fixed, a tracker, a discount, a capped. There are quite a few different ways of doing this, but it all depends on the client, really. The client wants some security of what they're paying every single month, and you can normally fix your interest rate for 1, 2, 3, 5, even 10 years. And typically what will happen if you fix your rate, it's a little bit more expensive than having a variable rate or a discounted rate or a tracker rate. So very few people these days will go straight onto a variable rate, purely because the lender will offer a gimmick, if you like, for the first 2 or 3 years. For example, you may have a tracker rate. And the way a tracker rate will work is that you have a set percentage above a tracker index, such as a Bank of England base rate. So you might find, for example, somebody will have a mortgage arrangement where they have 2% above the Bank of England base rate for 2 years, and after that go on to a variable rate. Now, inherent with that is the risk that if rates do go up, they'll be paying more for the mortgage every month. Whereas if you want some security, then you might find, well, I don't want to do that. I want to know what I'm paying for the next 2, 3, 5 years.
So if the Bank of England were to put their rate up 1 month, would you immediately see the next month the payment reflected in your mortgage repayments if you had a variable rate?
Yes, you would. I mean, depending on the lender's criteria, normally that would happen.
And what about an interest-only mortgage?
On a monthly basis, an interest-only mortgage obviously is cheaper. In the long run, it's more expensive because you have to bear in mind, let's say, for example, you borrow $100,000 over 25 years. Yes, during the period, you're paying a lot less per month. But at the end of 25 years, you've just paid 25 years' payments on interest. And then you have to find the money to pay back the capital balance. So when you work out the overall payment over 25 years, it's more expensive to have it on interest-only than just to have it on a repayment mortgage.
And what would be the benefits of having an interest-only mortgage then?
Monthly cost. I believe it's the right thing for the right person, although at the moment they're being phased out. Lenders are viewing that they need to have some security these loans are going to be paid off at the end of the term. So you might find, for example, interest-only mortgages would be very good for someone who will feel that in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years their income's going to increase substantially. And you may find someone having interest-only for the first 2 or 3 years for affordability, and then they can convert to a repayment mortgage after, say, 3 or 4 years.
And the average age of a first-time buyer at the moment?
I think it depends on which city you're living in, really, and the cost of the house or the property. I think years ago, traditionally, there are two things which are traditional, that maybe the one would buy their house at between the ages of between 23, 24 and 28. And for some reason, somebody's made up a 25-year mortgage, so everyone seemed to adopt the 25-year mortgage. So people are finishing their mortgages now close towards 50. However, these days, people are going to university a lot longer, and so they have their inheriting debts, it's taking longer to pay it. In quite an affluent city where the prices are quite high, then obviously they need a bigger deposit, and this takes more time. So I'm seeing first-time buyers now at the age of 35. Today, for example, I saw a client at 38, typical example, as a first-time buyer. And also on top of that, they're looking at extending the term beyond 25 years for affordability. So whereas you might find someone finishing their mortgage at 50, you'll probably find now that there are mortgages now to the age of 70 and 75.
Are there any special dispensations for people with student loan debt?
I think obviously with the student loan debts, you won't have to pay that back until you're earning a certain level of income. But it's viewed as debt, as a loan, and typically it'll be multiplied, your monthly payment will be multiplied by 12 and taken off your income before one starts to look at the affordability for a new mortgage. So it's an issue and it's a problem, but it's only one factor in your equation. So there could be lots of other issues which could help them offset the fact they have a monthly payment coming out.
But you're seeing a lot more contributions from parents in comparison to, say, 10 years ago.
Oh, yes, definitely. Most lenders will accept a gift from a parent. It has to be a gift, a non-returnable, non-interest-bearing gift to their children, really. And there are some very, very good schemes at the moment. Lenders are trying to engineer something which gives them some security but enables first-time buyers to buy. But there is a lender who will allow, for example, the parent to gift 5%, and then also to maybe the parent to hold a 10% bond in an account for 3 years, which effectively gives their child a 15% deposit, and the parent will have that bond back in 3 years' time.
So how much attention do you have to pay to the property market as part of your job?
No, I have a natural interest in property and in finance, which, like I said, I've been doing for about 25 years. I love it. I love everything about it. I love architecture. I love looking after people when they're buying properties as well, especially first-time buyers. It's a quite daunting thing when someone's buying a property to try and understand how leases work and crossover leases, freeholds and so on and so forth. So for me, it's very important that when you have someone buying for the first time, it's just to listen to what they do know and don't know, explain the market. I feel quite protective of them so that they don't go anywhere where they may be taken advantage of. And most of the time, I'm always reading other markets. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer. What I will do is give them rough guidelines and give them a booklet to take away the rough guidelines. They need to refer to a lawyer to get to grips exactly how today's legal system is working on freehold and leasehold, and every property is different.
What kind of advice do you have for someone that's remortgaging, somebody that's definitely not a first-time buyer?
Well, I think the best thing really to do is to go and speak to an independent mortgage broker, and the reason for this is the first port of call is your existing lender, because quite often it's a bit of a game here. An existing lender doesn't want to lose you as a client, but then again, sometimes can't afford to give you a deal that someone could do on remortgaging. So the comparison is really to speak to existing lenders, see what they have to offer, and then to compare that with the open market, and then you have to compare the fees and charges and surveys and so on. So when you remortgage a property to a different lender, you are effectively buying the property from yourself again, so you have to engage a solicitor, a survey, and sometimes on remortgaging these are free. So it's not complicated, but a lot of factors to consider when remortgaging, really. And probably the question I'd ask is, why are you remortgaging, really? Have your circumstances changed from the first time you had the mortgage? So once we know all those things, we can come back and then give a report. And it's just a pure mathematical equation.
But quite a complicated one, I would imagine, and something that an aspect of that may not get picked up if you're doing, say, a compare and contrast on one of the search engines on the internet.
I find everything these days is automated. When I started this years and years and years ago, a mortgage was arranged by, I would know the local branch manager. I would phone up and explain the application. We'd agree it over the phone. It was a paper base. You could do a covering letter. It was a lovely world to work in. These days, 90% of applications are done through electronic process. There's no human being behind it. So if you think you can qualify for a mortgage and you apply, and for some reason you're rejected, you'd have been credit scored and credit checked. And you do this 2, 3, 4, 5 times, and for some reason you're not qualifying, it can affect your credit rating. So the most important part for a mortgage broker is to understand what an underwriter wants on application. And that's why you should use a mortgage broker.
Thanks there to Phil Clark, Director of Bristol Mortgages Online. Before we meet our next guest, let's hear some film music. This track is from The Mission. It's called Gabriel's Oboe and was composed by Ennio Morricone.
Thank you.
Our next guest is a filmmaker, Colin Grange, and he's here in the studio to tell you how to get into the film industry. Welcome, Colin.
Hi.
You're a film producer and director based in Bristol, but international, really.
International, yes.
Aspirations. Can you tell us about what you're working on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm doing a trade commercial. You know, when you say producer, director, it sums up big fantasies of feature films, and not quite there yet. So still trying to earn a living from my trade, producing really whatever I can in terms of paid work. So producing director sounds a bit ambitious, but that's where I'm going, yes, definitely. So at the moment I'm working on a trade commercial for an engineering company that do forensics equipment for police labs, and the basic idea is to create a film for them that will be shown on a big screen at trade fairs. And
so an exposition of what they do to draw people into their trade stall and to really...
Yes. I mean, a lot of the equipment that they make is so large and heavy and expensive, it's impossible to ship it around the world. So the idea to make a film that can then be dubbed into other languages and put on trade stands.
And are you finding it interesting? Because I can imagine every single job you have... you get to a certain in-depth knowledge of your filming.
That is absolutely true, yeah, absolutely. I don't think, however boring you might think some of the jobs you get are, you always learn something from them. Yeah, certainly, I mean, I've learned quite a lot about forensic equipment doing this one, which is always adds to your knowledge.
I can imagine that makes for quite an interesting conversation piece. It's not the run-of-the-mill what anybody would expect working in an office. You get quite specialised in one area, whereas you get to dip into lots of different people's jobs, I would imagine.
I think that's the interesting bit, is that you become a part of a project for the duration, however many weeks it is you're filming. And we've done pieces for the foyer, which was very interesting, working with some of the kids at the foyer for a little while, and did a comedy film, which was working in quite a lot of locations around the southwest. So you sort of get little windows into people's lives doing all of these things. And some of the things that people are doing, I think it's interesting, whatever kind of film I'm at. I'm not always keen on repeating myself so much as I am on just doing something new. But obviously, you have to do whatever you're paid to do. But yeah, certainly, I think it's always the variety and the different windows into people's lives you get, particularly when you're sort of doing little documentary pieces about community projects sometimes and whatever it is, yeah.
So how have you generally found that people approach you? Do you have a website presence? Do you work from referrals? How is it going for you so far?
I seem to just fall into it. I just seem to be lucky enough that I'm talking to somebody either next to them or they know somebody, and I just sort of fall into work, really. And it's sort of been that way for the last 5 years. Some of the projects are quite small and some of them have been quite ambitious, and at the moment I'm just trying to keep that snowball rolling.
So if we weren't to go to trade fairs, would we likely see any of your stuff on the internet, or what kind of exposure does the various projects that you get given?
Right, well, some of it is... I did a music video for a company called Purple Music, which is on YouTube at the moment, and that was another job that just dropped out of the blue. The remit was to create... it was quite a low-budget video for a song that was being released on their record label, which was 2J's guerrilla-style filming in a little cafe and setting up some blue screen in the basement. We shot it in sort of 2 days, edited in about a week, and got that out online. A lot of the stuff, you won't find it really online, because they are commission projects for a specific organisation. It gets shown at their AGM or something like that, and it ends up on the website. But I don't really follow up anything I do. There are bits and pieces that have found their way onto the internet from years ago that I really wish hadn't, and I think there's a kind of a feeling that I have that, you know, it's almost slightly disposable, that I'm happy to do the commission, but it's apart from taking a few clips to put on a showreel, I don't worry too much about what happens to it afterwards at the moment. I mean, it's commissioned work, it's for somebody else, so I don't actually take any particular and personal pleasure from watching it in a way. It's always a case of moving on, that I try to make each thing I do a little bit better than the last. And it's all a bit of a journey to getting where I want to be, which is ultimately producing, directing one of my own films, getting the funding to do that. So it's kind of an ongoing process, sort of earn as you learn.
When you get jobs, does it differ how much people ask you to be creative?
So far, I think I've been really lucky that every single project that I've done has been really open, that I've come across people who have not really got any vision for what they want. They want that from me, which I find the best way to work, because then you can work with them to achieve a kind of result that everyone's going to be happy with. I think very often some of the worst projects have been where I've been had someone say, well, we definitely want to do this and we don't want to do that. They don't really understand how to ask for what they want, and then you've got this kind of ongoing problem. They're trying to control something that they don't know how to control, whereas, you know, if somebody comes to me saying, this is the kind of thing we want, then I can sort of say, well, I could do this. We've got facilities to do that. And if you want us to do what you're saying, actually, that's going to cost a hell of a lot more money. And that's really where the problems lie, that people don't realise quite how expensive some things are going to be. And then when they actually find out, well, can't you do it this way? And you sort of, well, you could try it that way, but it's not going to work and you're not going to be happy with it. Whereas if you sort of say, actually, we've got an idea, we just want to promote this or to do that, I can sort of show them what my box of tricks is that we can pull out and work with that. Usually that is a more enjoyable process, and I actually enjoy being inventive and creative.
Does that stem from your background, do you believe? Because I understand you have a past in music.
Yeah, definitely on a level. I worked on music. Basically, you're creating soundscapes. You're creating a scene with music and with words and lyrics. And the technology on the editing side of it is, of course, quite similar. Programmed like Pro Tools and Logic, Cubase, all of the main projects. When you get into using things like Avid and Final Cut Pro for video editing, the principles are all very similar and you're still creating. I think that is really where the filmmaking started. Although I always wanted to be a filmmaker, I fell into doing the music because I was interested in the technical side of it, and this was at a time when dance music was just starting to rise up in London. And I just happened to sort of get in at that time. So I found myself working in a lot of studios around London with a lot of the DJs and producers at the time. And I just sort of fell into that, really. When you're working with music, you're thinking of the writing of the lyrics, I suppose. We didn't actually have that many song-based projects, but certainly creating soundscapes that I always wanted to put pictures to. And I think I got very frustrated at the end of that actually I would rather have been shooting a video for the music we were creating than be behind a mixing desk trying to sound balance it and write it. And I think that was definitely why I made that progression. I wanted to get out of the studio and behind a camera. And initially I got jobs as a sound recordist. The thing that frustrated me, I think, with that for a while was that you just have a lot of background noise. So where I went from being in a sound studio where you had a perfectly controlled environment to a situation where there's cars and birds and people coughing, and you just want to surround everything with a soundproof booth that you can't. So it just seemed like a natural progression at the time to go from one to the other. But I just basically found out that I quite enjoy being on the organisational side, that I'd rather be working with a crew than be part of the crew, although I do enjoy that. It's nice to be part of a creative team, but I just found generally I was sort of better at organising, and so that's why I sort of moved on more into the production side of it.
Sounds like a hard-won journey, but that's an interesting progression. So did you go into post-production first?
Well, I built up my own equipment. I didn't find it that hard to go from post-production in audio to post-production in video. Went into post-production really because one of my first jobs was working for a production company that did a lot of corporate work, and very often there wasn't the facility to have an editor, so I would basically have to shoot and edit myself, and I would be given an edit suite to work in and just had to work it out, basically. And that's where I just sort of discovered, really, actually, it's not that different working with video to audio. And so the post-production sound came out of necessity.
Thanks, Colin. Tim Burrows has escaped from bad weather and is now in southern India. But we have in the studio Trevor Carter, otherwise known as the Bard of Windmill Hill. Hello, Trevor. What have you got for us this week?
The Rise and Fall of Western Civilization. It's based on Niall Ferguson's book, Civilization, the Six Killer Apps. Out of the churches and into consumption, rejecting religion, discovering sex. Forsaking tradition for representation. Forsaking of letters for digital text. Rule Rude Britannia, Coca-Colarization. Faster and harder, selling the brand. No time for losers, homogenization. Longer and stronger, businessman's hand. More and more testing, more and more grading, more and more tables, history is dead. More and more questing, more and more trading of logos and labels, corporate-led. Enter the era of constant sensation, corporate slick tricks pervading the web, naked self-interest, commodification, death of decorum in search of street cred. 500 years of civilization, now it's the end game, so say the signs. Public dismay in each privatized nation, age of Aquarius, unsettling times.
Thanks to Trevor Carter.
That's all from Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski. The producer, Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
And me, Kay Sangandaffy.
Until next week, goodbye.
Bye.